classic British comedy Fawlty Towers, specifically the 1975 episode where Basil, about to host some German tourists, warns his staff, "Don't mention the war." The phrase has since achieved meme-like status to warn against speaking about things that could cause an argument or tension. Which returns us to the larger question, the status of truth today, and what that larger question means for intelligence. I have no doubt that officers and offices, within the resource constraints set by the president's determination of priorities, will continue their professional duty to collect and analyze intelligence. I'm actually more concerned about the presentation of intelligence, and not only on the Russia question. It is always a difficult question of how, when, where, and to what degree to push back against preferred policy narratives when they slip the bonds of what the IC believes to be objective reality. This is more than a question of simple honesty. There are real issues of effectiveness involved as well. Push too hard on one issue, and you likely lose access and relevance for others. Push not enough, and you can see the course of action that is unproductive at best, and sometimes a lot worse. This is a complicated relationship. Mark Lowenthal was the chief of analysis for the entire intelligence community for several years under DCI George Tenet. Mark is a smart and thoughtful man, 1988 Jeopardy grand champion, no less, author of several books on intelligence and analysis. A few years ago, he wrote, "Policymakers do more than receive intelligence. They shape it. Without a constant reference to policy, intelligence is rendered meaningless. Policymakers can exist without the intelligence community," Lowenthal adds, "but the intelligence community cannot exist without them." Which isn't to say that policymakers get to shape their intelligence in terms of what its conclusions might be, but rather that in addition to being competent and honest, intelligence needs to be relevant and useful. And relevance and utility are largely in the hands of the policymaker, and especially of the president. And this president, at various times, has signaled his distrust, questioned the credibility, risked the capabilities, and downplayed the value of his intelligence community. And after 10 months in office, when asked about vacancies in various foreign policy positions that historically have advised the White House, famously responded that this shouldn't be a concern because I'm the only one that matters. So when do you push? When do you concede? And when do you walk? This is hard. And although the nation should be grateful to those who have not, it might be right for some people to take a pass. About 2 or 3 months into the administration, I received a phone call from an old colleague who said he might be on a very short list for a very senior position. He asked my opinion. I told him that 3 months earlier, I would have talked to him about his duty. 6 weeks ago, I would have told him to follow his conscience. Now I'm telling him, say no. He breathed an audible sigh of relief and said, thank you. That was where his head and heart had been, but he feared he was just being selfish. I told him that I didn't think that he was, that I doubted he could make any fundamental difference, that he would be frustrated and then tarred by the other activities of the administration, and that he wouldn't finish out the term. You're a young man, I said. Don't put yourself at risk for the future. You have a lot to offer. Someday. Months later, I talked with a recently retired case officer, something of an agency legend, who told me something similar. He was glad to be out, he said, after establishing his apolitical credentials by telling me that he hadn't voted since homeroom. He said that he was very happy not to be at the office coffee pot after one tweet or another and being asked by a junior officer, "Hey, chief, what do you think?" He didn't speculate on how he would answer, but repeated to me what he thought was the important question. How will I be judged? And again, for emphasis, how will history judge me? Which applies to institutions at least as much as it applies to individuals, especially since institutions don't have the freedom to opt out. And that judgment of history might be the most important question that American intelligence as an enterprise faces today. Preserving relevance and utility is indeed important, but there have to be limits. History and the next president will judge American intelligence, and if it is found to have been too accommodating to this or any president, it will be disastrous for the community. When asked for counsel these days by serving officers, I usually respond with something like, "Do your duty," and then remind them of their responsibility to help the duly elected president succeed. Elections matter. I then add, protect yourself, take notes and save them, and above all, protect the institution. America still needs it. A lot of the noises from Washington these days are, thankfully, the sounds of American institutions pushing back against a president who routinely sounds authoritarian, but whose office lacks the wherewithal, at least for now, to actually be so. That was the not-so-hidden context of Donald Trump Jr.'s complaint to a group of young conservative activists in late December that there are people at the highest levels of government that don't want to let America be America. I was thrown that quote by Don Lemon on CNN a few minutes after getting off a train in Washington that same evening and instinctively responded that I thought that it was an appeal to the heart of autocracy. It was. And I'm glad I said it, because the current line of confrontation in Washington over presidential power is not the one designed by the founders, the one that should exist between the executive and Congress, which has been surprisingly compliant, but between the executive and the other institutions of government and civil society. But Lemon's question and my answer highlighted an important issue. I feel that my credentials to comment on air are based on my intelligence experience. I am, or at least try to be, the fact witness. Given the president's routine distance from the facts, I often appear to be in opposition. The Washington Post recorded nearly 2,000 false or misleading statements by the president in just his first year. 2,000. But I'm not the opposition, and I'm certainly not the resistance. I actually look for things positive to say about the administration. For instance, the decision to stay the course in Afghanistan or pushing battlefield decision-making down to the tactical level. There are now quite a few former intelligence officials on the 24/7 news networks. Phil Mudd, former counterterrorism analyst at both CIA and FBI. Michael Morell, former acting director of CIA. Jeremy Bash, Leon Panetta's former chief of staff, Leon Panetta himself, John McLaughlin, former deputy director and acting director of CIA, Jim Clapper, former director of national intelligence, occasionally John Brennan, former DCIA. The list goes on. Current CIA leadership is, at least publicly, less than thrilled with the phenomenon. In October 2017, Mike Pompeo complained, "There are an awful lot of former CIA talking heads on TV," adding that their obligation to remain quiet about their work far extends beyond the day you turn in your badge. I suspect that Director Pompeo's legitimate concerns about security might have been reinforced by the morning-after comments of a cable news-fixated president. Michael Morell, after echoing Pompeo's caution against leaking, appropriately added, "But to be clear, critiquing policy is not leaking." Still, there is no doubt the comments of people like me, Clapper, McLaughlin, Brennan, Morell, and others, have created the impression in the minds of some, many, that we are merely the public voice of a deep state intelligence community opposed to Donald Trump. If we are, we aren't very efficient. We don't coordinate on commentary. What you see on air is what you get. If there is broad consistency, It is the product of a common worldview and shared life experiences, not an orchestrated theme of the week. Mike Morrell seems to have a bit of buyer's remorse, suggesting that his criticism of Trump and endorsement of Clinton during the campaign may have helped accelerate the estrangement between Trump and the IC, and that he, Morrell, should have thought more about the potential downsides to the intelligence community from that. Michael included my criticism of the candidate's campaign language and policies. I did not endorse Clinton as a contributing cause as well. Perhaps it was. But I was telling the truth as I believed it to be. Both of us have been commenting on the networks for years, and although neither of us signed on just to oppose Trump, pointing out things that weren't true just seemed the right thing to do. And there was no escaping the IC findings about the Russian intervention. Since the inauguration, the two most senior leaders of the community under Barack Obama, DNI Jim Clapper and DCIA John Brennan, joined in with somewhat more basic challenges to the president's character and competence. One of Clapper's early TV appearances raised questions about Trump's fitness for office, a comment that excited some emails from more traditional senior intelligence alumni about staying above politics. But there is what diplomats call a range of views on that subject. I live a short distance from the agency and have frequent chance encounters with currently serving officers. What I hear from them is thank you and keep it up. Some of that is certainly just politeness. Some of it, perhaps gratitude for some earlier TV appearances defending them and their work. But I suspect at least part of it is about what is being said now. Still, the longer we are on air, the more the questions trend toward a value judgment of the president himself and not just the president's actions, as it becomes increasingly clear that he will not change, that the office will not shape the man, and that, in fact, it has been and will be the other way around. So how do individuals and institutions hold their ground without being destructive and judged as reflexively negative, as being the opposition or part of the resistance? Tough work, and it may get tougher. The president has already tweeted that the entire Department of Justice is the deep state and has called for the jailing of a political opponent, Huma Abedin. And that was largely without any proximate provocation. He also told a New York Times reporter, "I have an absolute right to do what I want to do with the Justice Department." Adam Schiff, a senior Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, is a smart man, but he is also a political animal. So I'm not sure what to make of his December tweet. Here is what we know. The Russians offered help. The campaign accepted help. The Russians gave help. The president made full use of that help. Remember John McLaughlin's four stages of the Trump intelligence relationship? Chapter 4? We have traversed three. Ignorance, hostility, unavoidability. Sometime in 2018, we will reach John's fourth stage. What happens after Special Counsel Bob Mueller reports out? It is not impossible to imagine even more difficult circumstances post-Mueller. Or what if the talented people around the president, the axis of adults as described in the press, the benign junta, as someone else described it to me, cannot contain the president's worst impulses with regard to Korea or Iran or some other trouble spot? I began this book with a stroll through wartime Sarajevo, an observation about the fragility of civilization, and a caution that I was not predicting civil war or societal collapse here. I am still not making such a prediction. But these are truly uncharted waters for the Republic, and I am saying that with full knowledge of other crises we have successfully faced. But there, most often we argued over the values to be applied to objective reality, or occasionally over what constituted objective reality. not the existence or the relevance of objective reality itself. Timothy Snyder keeps coming back to the importance of reality and truth in his magnificent pamphlet-length book, On Tyranny. To abandon facts, he writes, is to abandon freedom. If nothing is true, then no one can criticize power because there is no basis to do so. He then chillingly observes, post-truth is pre-fascism. Nothing is free or guaranteed in this world. On a recent visit to CIA, as I was standing near the iconic shield in the Grand Lobby, I was approached by a young officer who was anxious to introduce himself and tell me his story. He was a master of several Arabic dialects. He had been born in Iraq and first became associated with America as a translator for U.S. forces during the heavy fighting in Anbar province. He later made his way to this country, had an opportunity to attend an Ivy League college, but opted to serve in the Army instead. He became a cryptologic linguist, working for several years for NSA, helping non-native Arabic-speaking fellow soldiers master the intricacies of the language. He then applied for and was accepted by CIA, where he was, with obvious enthusiasm, putting his skills to good use. He would not, I should note, have been allowed to enter the United States had the administration's first immigration ban been in place at the time. I was at the agency that day to attend the retirement ceremony of a Chinese-American officer who had supported me in my overseas travel while director, and I got to meet her still very Chinese parents and, of course, a bunch of other officers. I left the headquarters building that day with a little more hope than when I entered. For me, that morning felt more like America and its promise than I was routinely seeing elsewhere. Still, I wondered if the officers I saw at the ceremony realized how much we are now counting on them. If there are those who do not, this book intends to remind them that we're looking to them to guard their own integrity, look to the long-term health of their institution, stand tall in the bunker, and continue to tell the truth. We are accustomed to relying on their truth-telling to protect us from foreign enemies. Now, we may need their truth-telling to save us from ourselves. Afterward. Early in the afternoon of February 16th, 2018, Getaway Friday of President's Day weekend for the federal workforce, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein entered a Department of Justice auditorium to announce to the press, to the world, and to Vladimir Putin that the United States was indicting 13 Russian nationals and three Russian companies for committing federal crimes while seeking to interfere in the United States political system, including the 2016 presidential election. Let that sink in. Crimes. Real crimes. No phony. No hoax. No witch hunt. No fake news. Rosenstein's comments in the accompanying indictment followed the familiar arc of what the intelligence community had been saying for more than a year. And beneath the bland charges of identity theft, bank fraud, wire fraud, and conspiracy to defraud the United States, the indictment cataloged stunning operational details. The defendants had conducted what they themselves called information warfare through fictitious U.S. personas on social media platforms and other internet-based media with a goal to sow discord and spread distrust towards the candidates and the political system in general, by supporting the presidential campaign of then-candidate Donald J. Trump and disparaging Hillary Clinton. They engaged in operations primarily intended to communicate derogatory information about Hillary Clinton, to denigrate other candidates such as Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, and to support Bernie Sanders and then-candidate Donald Trump. President Trump had been alerted to the indictments shortly before Rosenstein stepped to the podium, and by mid-afternoon had tweeted, "Russia started their anti-U.S. campaign in 2014, long before I announced that I would run for president. The results of the election were not impacted. The Trump campaign did nothing wrong. No collusion." Rosenstein had been careful to emphasize that this indictment made no claim about witting American collusion with the Russians, nor whether the Russians had any effect on the election. But with the indictment and Rosenstein's carefully crafted statement, the president, the intelligence community, and America had entered what John McLaughlin had said would be phase four of the IC-Trump relationship. Recall that John had cataloged the sequence of that relationship as first ignorance. The candidate and his team knew little about the intelligence business, followed by hostility, charges of Nazis, political hacks, and such, and developing into inevitability, jettisoning, "I'm like a smart person. I don't have to be told the same thing," in favor of regular briefings. Phase four, John had predicted, would start when Mueller began to report his findings. And so he has. And the former FBI director appears far from being done. Washington is alive with stories of his interest in Trump Tower meetings, Trump finances, Russian money, campaign communications, and a proposed Moscow hotel, and is possibly interviewing the president. The president, for his part, has lashed out against practically everyone except Russia and Putin since the indictment. He didn't just contradict, but publicly humiliated his national security advisor after H.R. McMaster told a security conference in Munich that evidence of Russian interference was now incontrovertible. The president quickly and angrily tweeted a critique. "General McMaster forgot to say that the results of the 2016 election were not impacted or changed by the Russians, and that the only collusion was between Russia and Crooked H, the DNC, and the Dems. Remember the dirty dossier, uranium, speeches, emails, and the Podesta Company." The tweet was a melange of inaccuracies, vagaries, conspiracy theories, and shop-worn accusations, and it must have made for a long flight back to Washington for HR. Trying to project closure as well as alert the Europeans, he had succeeded only in provoking his boss, undercutting his own status, and laying bare America's post-truth divisions for all to see. Still, McMaster's view was supported by American intelligence in two remarkable appearances that bookended Rosenstein's press conference. The first was the worldwide threat briefing in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee, an annual event designed to give both the Senate and the public an appreciation of global circumstances, but an event that has just as often been diverted by the news or crisis of the day. On the Tuesday before Rosenstein's blockbuster, Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats was joined by the heads of three-letter agencies like CIA, NSA, and the FBI to give his assessment. He kept the emphasis on cyber dangers that have marked such testimony for several years now. Proliferation of weapons of mass destruction followed, with terrorism third on his list. Coats added a new entry, emerging threats in space, and concluded with transnational crime. That was solid, if unremarkable, fare, but I was struck that, apocalyptic campaign rhetoric to the contrary, terrorism no longer enjoyed its once dominant focus, and in the fine print of the DNI statement, there were other observations that deviated from administration orthodoxy. I wondered, for example, how Coates' comment that North Korea sees nuclear weapons as essential to regime survival would affect any American negotiating position with Pyongyang. So, too, with the observation that the Iranian nuclear deal puts Tehran further away from a weapon than it would otherwise be and continues to contribute to our visibility into that program. One didn't need to read the fine print to see the unwavering intelligence community consensus that the Russians interfered in the 2016 election and planned to do the same in 2018. In his opening remarks, Coates predicted that Russian operations will continue against the United States and our European allies, using elections as opportunities to undermine democracy, sow discord, and undermine our values, and then added, "There should be no doubt that Russia perceived its past efforts as successful and views the 2018 U.S. midterm elections as a potential target for Russian influence operations." Later, one by one, the five intelligence chiefs at the witness table with Coates publicly confirmed that the president, despite their obvious concern, had not tasked them to focus on this issue or do much about it. Mike Rogers, the director of NSA, easily joined consensus that Tuesday. 2 weeks later, and 10 days after the Russia indictments, he was alone in front of the Senate Armed Services Committee in his dual-hatted role as commander of U.S. Cyber Command, and he was answering some of the same questions. There, Rogers predicted that, if we don't change the dynamic here, this is going to continue and 2016 won't be viewed as isolated. This is something that will be sustained over time. And then he offered this judgment. We're probably not doing enough. It hasn't changed the calculus. It certainly hasn't generated the change in behavior that I think we all know we need. That's a pretty clear warning, and a pretty good sign that American intelligence remains steadfast on this issue, and one hopes, more broadly, in its commitment to objective truth. It's also a pretty good sign that Phase 4 in the relationship between the IC and the president will be lengthy, contentious, divisive, and unpredictable. Stand by. This is Michael V. Hayden. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of The Assault on Intelligence, American National Security in an Age of Lies. This program was directed by Zane Birdwell. It was recorded by Adam Ruhner, and the executive producer is Aaron Blank. Text copyright 2018 by Michael V. Hayden. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.